The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So good evening, everyone. And one of the remarkable things about a gathering like this, people come from maybe many different places and arrive here to sit and meditate and hopefully listen to the Dharma being taught, is we're all here as companions in the journey from suffering to freedom from suffering. And that we come here with the idea that what we're doing here is addressing human suffering. You might not use that kind of language for yourself, but that's the traditional kind of Buddhist view, that everyone comes to the Dharma because of their suffering. And then to have companions on that journey with other people who are also not sitting at home and wallowing in their suffering or giving up because they're suffering or ignoring their suffering, but rather have some sense, maybe intuitive sense, some sense of possibility, or a clear sense that there's a path. There is a way of addressing and meeting this difficult life of ours. So that it gives some sense to it, it gives meaning to it, it gives a sense of direction, and more, most importantly, it provides a journey, a path to this freedom. So there's a poem, a little verse that the Buddha taught, and it's the first line that I wanted to read. I'll read the whole thing, but the first line is what I wanted to emphasize. It is faith that is one's partner. It is faith that is one's companion. And wisdom that instructs, delighting in release, a mortal is released from all suffering. Delighting in release, letting go. So this idea of that faith is our companion, I think that in English, the common way, maybe a question people could ask is, what do you have faith in? Or let me tell you what I have faith in. The idea that you have faith in something. In Buddhism, I don't think it's a matter of having faith in something, but rather it's to have faith with something. That faith, we have faith accompanies us, supports us. We have it with us, but the point is not to be in faith. That's not like the end of the path or the end of the journey to have end up with faith. But faith is what helps us begin the journey, and it accompanies us. It supports us. It guides us. It inspires us. It's an aid in this kind of the path that we're on. And so I wanted to try to talk a little bit today about this word sada, which is taken to be faith. And I recognize that for many people who speak English, the word faith might not be a popular word. They maybe have had challenges with their own maybe religion of upbringing that caused a crisis of faith. Their experience of faith is that you have to believe in a creed. And if you have faith, you have to kind of have blind belief in something, blind faith. It's possible the English word faith is not the appropriate translation for the Buddhist word sada. Some translators translate it as confidence. But I like faith because confidence seems a little bit more, it doesn't, in my mind, doesn't quite speak to the heart. Faith, to me, is a heartfelt word. And so the sense of heartfeltness, where you put your heart, what you kind of do wholeheartedly, is some of the connotations I have with the word faith. And the point in Buddhism is not to have faith. like I said, like that's the end of the path or the end of the journey. Like just, you know, you try to find your way until you finally have faith and then it's all good. But rather faith is what helps us, guides us, supports us to, in a sense, to come to the end of faith, where we no longer need faith. Faith is a temporary support and for our practice. It's not the purpose. And one of the most important, I don't know, most important, one of the important functions of faith is to inspire someone to begin the practice and then to stay on it. So that's, you know, it accompanies us, it supports us, it's like our cheerleader or the fuel for what we're going to do. And classically, the idea is what we're doing is becoming free of suffering. And this is such an important idea that one of the ancient descriptions of the journey of practice places faith as a second step of the journey. The first step is suffering. That suffering is the condition for the arising of faith. And so, how does that work? You know, if you don't suffer well, if you don't have enough suffering, you know, then you're not going to be interested in a way out of the suffering, a way of healing it or resolving it or passing through it to the other side. And so the suffering has to be there. I heard once someone give a talk that said that James Baldwin said that no one grows up without suffering. If a person doesn't suffer, they don't grow up. And so it isn't that you have to go out and look for suffering, just drum it up. You know, okay, I got to be a Buddhist and got to go get into some good trouble. But the idea is that we, you know, just being alive is challenging, and growing up is challenging. But at the core, there is a feeling of dissatisfaction that something's not quite aligned with the way that the world is set up and culture is set up, popular culture is set up to guide us, to tell us what is most important. And not a few people have begun a career, and with great enthusiasm, 10, 15, 20 years later, have thought, what in the world am I doing? This is, you know, this doesn't really have value for me. This was just a pursuit of money. This was just a pursuit of security. This is a pursuit of status. This was just a pursuit to please my parents or something. And it doesn't really speak to something deep, a deep longing or a deep calling or something. And so, as I said, in classic Buddhism, the idea is that something feels unsatisfactory. Something doesn't seem quite right. And sometimes that not quite right is, you know, is dramatic. The suffering and horrors that people have to go through are pretty amazing, some people in this world. And so the idea is not to just keep suffering, but the idea is to address it and work through it and find the other way. And so in that sense, suffering is the condition, the first step, from which we take the step of faith. We discover faith. We discover something that we trust. And sometimes it's borrowed faith. We meet someone who inspires us, who seems to have done enough of this journey of freedom, that that's what's possible. And so now the person trusts that this is possible, this is a journey. If that person has done that, then I'm going to do it as well. We don't really know it works, but it's just like, okay, I have evidence for something. I had a Buddhist teacher when I was young who I was very inspired by. And And he liked he taught through these what's called Zen koans, these kind of enigmatic questions or statements you have to kind of figure out. And I never quite got into those koans. I would do them and pass a koan, then he'd give me another one, and so you know I kind of you know went through a series of them. So it was kind of nice, but I wasn't doing it because I was interested in the koans. I was interested because I wanted to be with him, and that's what he was doing. That was kind of like the name of the game. If you want to hang out with me, you do these koans. I was inspired by him and his what he had become and who he was and his compassion, his care, his intelligence. So. In the suttas, in the ancient teachings, the primary function over and over again for why a person, for faith, the sadha, is to get a person started on the path of practice. And so maybe faith is not the best word, maybe confidence, you have confidence in something, or you trust it. And this is, you know, pretty straightforward. You know, there's a lot of endeavors that we do in life that we have no proof that it works or it's going to be good, but we give it the benefit of the doubt. We trust it. We have some faith. If you want to take a class at the local community college, and you don't know the teacher, you don't know never been at the college, and so you give it you have some faith that they're going to hire someone and the teacher is a good teacher and good enough, and that's worthwhile giving your money and taking the class. And so there's some trust, some faith goes in to starting something new. You want to learn to play a musical instrument or a new skill or almost anything. You grant a little bit of faith and trust to the people who are going to teach it to you. And then if it turns out that they are good teachers, then you have more confidence in them and you hang out with them. At some point, you learn the skill for yourself, and then you don't need to have faith in that teacher anymore, because now you know it for yourself, and now you can keep learning it and developing it on your own. So again, so what we're seeing here in that kind of emphasis is that faith is not something we're supposed to believe in blindly, but rather the purpose of it is to put fire under us, to motivate us to get started into practice, and then to stay with it. Okay, this is important. Let's hang in there. Let's have enough faith or enough fire so we're not just a weekend Buddhist. I'll sit, every day, but only on the weekends. Or so. There's also an expression that I heard many years ago. There's a nightstand Buddhists. And I guess nowadays it's the place you keep your iPad or something. But back then it was just you just read books about Buddhism. And then the way the tradition champions one of the ways it champions the role of faith is it says that faith is the greatest wealth. You can't take it too seriously because these ancient teachings point to a lot of things as the greatest wealth. But all of them are internal qualities. They're all things we keep inside of ourselves as opposed to something that we have external. And so to find something inside, to discover something and have a journey that takes us inward is not a popular idea. It's not like we get a lot of messages from society. Or for a lot of people, it takes a huge amount of trust or faith to dedicate a serious amount of time to cultivate an inner life. One of the common protests is that it's selfish, that that's not where what's important is at. What we have to do, given how terrible things are going on in our society these days, that we have to go out there and do something, and to turn inward is going the wrong direction. But to have faith that this is worthwhile, that some people have to get to the bottom of our suffering, get to the bottom of our attachments, our clinging, our distress that we have, and really kind of work through the knots of the heart, work through the attachments, find the possibility of freedom, of peace, of happiness. Someone has to do it. Because if no one does it, then why bother with all the rest? When I came to a junction in my life where it was whether to go to graduate school or go to a Buddhist monastery. So that was a big decision. Okay, I had two paths diverged in a young person's life. So which do I go? And graduate school was to go and study soil science, soil conservation. I was aware of that soil erosion was a huge problem around the globe, and I felt like I really wanted to. Not a lot of people knew about it, but I had been trained in agriculture, and I wanted to address it. I wanted to be involved. I felt motivated by that. And so, what do I do? Do I go and address this problem of global dimension? Or do I go to a little, teeny little monastery deep in the wilderness and sit and look at my breathing for days and weeks and years at a time? And so what direction do I go? And it was, kind of a challenge for me because on one hand, I was going to go off and try to address some of the big problems of human society and suffering people had. But what I ended up deciding was that given what I had learned about practice in the heart by that time, that no matter how much work I did in the field of soil conservation, that the people that I helped would still be suffering. They might have food, they might have, improved life in many ways that was important to do, but I could still feel that they'd be suffering. They wouldn't really address some of the core attachments to self, the core kind of conceits that we have, the core kind of ways in which we're driven by greed, hatred, and delusion. And I felt at some point that I would remain unsatisfied if I was addressing that level of suffering. Important to address, I'm not denying it, but that wasn't going to be my way. That I felt I'm going to do something that I'm going to attempt to try to address suffering at its heart, at its roots. And I didn't think I would be very successful. Maybe I'm not. But the image I had was that I was going to I'd end up doing with my life was I'd learn to meditate well, and then I would somehow be the custodian of a small little urban meditation hall. But much smaller than this room, maybe like a third of the size of this room or something. And my job was just to open the door every day so people can come and sit and keep it clean. I wasn't going to teach her anything. I was just going to be the custodian for the meditation hall. So that was, that's about as bold as I could think of what I could do. But I felt like I wanted to be able to somehow have a life that was dedicated to help people get to the root of their suffering. And that's still what I think my life is about, what I want to do. That there's a path, there are teachings, there are practices that we can do, and there's a way through it to get the other side. But it requires a lot of confidence, a lot of trust, and a lot of faith to be able to be honest about what our distress is, what our fear is, what our ways in which we're caught, entangled, attached, the ways in which we suffer. And that's not an easy thing to do. There can be a lot of forces to get people to prevent them to looking, to deny, to ignore, to be embarrassed, to feel like, this is not important. We're supposed to be happy-go-lucky, and, if you're a Buddhist, after all, you're supposed to be kind of just full of love and compassion and, just have it all together. And so it's easy to kind of think, I can't admit that I'm suffering. Buddhist practice really takes off when we can recognize and see and know, oh, this is my suffering. And the faith part, what it can help us do is to be able to breathe easily in that suffering, to be able to have some faith, confidence, trust that this is worthwhile to stay here. This is important. Not so I can suffer better, but so I can suffer in such a way to find the release from suffering. I can come to understand it so that I can come to find out what's really going on here, and so that I can find a different way of being, a different way of living in this life, a different way of seeing this life, different values perhaps that are freeing rather than entangling. And so faith is to have faith that that's possible. It's supported by teachings such as the Four Noble Truths, which is a very simple teaching that if you cling, you will suffer. If you let go of that clinging, the suffering ends. That's a kind of pretty simple and maybe memorable little teaching. It's kind of Gill's version of it. But, wow. If I cling, I will suffer. If I cling, I will suffer. So, are you going to cling? Some of you are nodding your head. Maybe you're just being honest. Yes, I don't want to, but I will. And so one of the purposes of sitting and meditating is not to live a relaxed, mindful life. I think that the way that mindfulness is taught now in our secular society has kind of departed from the core purpose of mindfulness that originally you had in Buddhism. And that was the idea of mindfulness and meditation in Buddhism is to really sit quiet and still, upright, alert, in order to really see what's going on in a deep way, to really get to the bottom of attachments, of clinging, of fear, of distress, of hatred, of confusion that we live our life in, to really sit there. And to face it over and over and over again, to see it again and again, and to do it with such faith, with such dedication, that it brings a kind of joy. The sequence of one of the classic descriptions of the path of practice is you start with suffering, you have faith, which puts fire into your life to start doing, practicing something different, and that brings gladness, that brings a certain kind of delight. Wow, I'm so fortunate. There's a path here. I'm engaged in something meaningful. There's a way out. I'm not good at it yet. I don't know how to do it yet, but I know there's a way. I'm going to learn this. And then that delight, in the description, the next step is joy. The joy of actually engaging in practice. So this is a pretty important thing, to engage in it, to do it. I kind of maybe in a mischievous way like to say sometimes that the practice doesn't work, and I'll pause. By the way, this practice doesn't work unless you do it. You got to do it. And then the joy of having found something that begins to work, to find how some of the stress and the tension of our life begins to relax, to find something that helps us to see what we're doing, what's driving us, what we're holding on to see that our attachments, to really see them and begin to release their grip, to soften them, and to begin having a visceral experience of release, of relaxation, of kind of the veils beginning to fall from our eyes, and being able to see a whole different way of living. At that point, faith becomes less important, because at that point, what gets replaced, the faith morphs into confidence. The language is confidence based on knowing, or a peaceful confidence, or a verified confidence. There's a variety of words in which that ways this is translated, this ancient word. But at some point, you know something for yourself, and you know this works if I do it. I know people who know it works, but they're busy. Until the suffering is bad enough. Something happens in their life, and then things kind of fall apart in their life. And then they say, well, you know, I'm going to go and practice. Now I'm finally going to go and retreat. Now I'm going to go. I've known people, when I was in the monasteries, I met that. Somehow that's a magnet for monasteries sometimes, for people whose lives fall apart. Nothing else makes any sense. Or they need something. They need some medicine, some path to really work through their challenges and difficulties they have. I'm thinking of some examples that I've seen. Once when I arrived at the monastery to be there for some years, and there was a person who had been a stockbroker. And it was after one of those big stock market crashes. And not only did he lose a lot of his money, but he lost the money of lots of his clients. And so he just didn't make sense. His life as he lived didn't make any more sense for him. And he wanted something different. So he went to the monastery to practice and really address and get underneath the surface of his heart and really see what was going on. There was one, I don't know if this is quite an example, but it comes to mind. It's kind of a remarkable story, I think. Maybe inspiring. It depends what's going on. But there was, I was teaching a retreat, and this woman came to the retreat, and I asked her, have you ever been on retreat before? And she said, no. And what brought you here? And she said, well, my husband brought me here and dropped me off. You see, And she said, you see, I had an affair, and this is what my husband said I had to do. Maybe so their relationship could survive or something. So hopefully that was wise. I didn't hear what happened afterwards, the retreat. So sometimes dramatic things have to happen, and then people will start sitting. I have friends who are teachers in Hawaii, and they say that in Hawaii it's hard to get people to be motivated to practice, because if you don't feel good, you go surfing. You go to the beach. So sometimes life can be a distraction. I have two kids that I've been raising. And I'm not really particularly trying to make them Buddhists. They certainly grew up with it all around them. But what I am trying to do with my children is to give them just enough contact with the Buddhist practice and the Buddhist kind of teachings so that at some point in their adult life, if they ever need it, it's not only is it available to them, but they have a feeling of being at home in it, like it's kind of like theirs and they can be there for it. Because someday they might suffer, and then they have this resource. So this path goes from suffering to faith to delight to joy, and then tranquility. So if I discover a degree of deep sense of calm and well-being. And then this wonderful description of the path goes on to happiness. Happiness goes to developing concentration. Concentration goes to seeing things as they are. To really see, to really know what's going on, to have wisdom and understanding about all this. One of the things that the Buddha emphasized as being really key about seeing things as they are is that really kind of confirms the faith, verifies what we have faith in the Buddha Dharma. Really kind of so you really know what it's all about for yourself. If you hear it, it can seem like just a very simplistic thing and it doesn't seem like some great religious experience. So you have to kind of, you know, give it some thought or reflection about it. And this is to know that you have craving, greed, that you've been caught in the grip of lust or something, to recognize it in your mind, and then to recognize that it's no longer there. To have resentment or jealousy or hatred, to recognize it's there, and then to recognize it's no longer there. To have envy, to have confusion, delusion, fear, and then recognize it's no longer there. There's something about that that gives people the confirmed confidence that it's possible to have a mind or a heart that's free of those afflictions. And that is the heart of the practice. To discover how to have a heart, a mind that's afflictive-free, that's at ease, that's at peace, that has a sense of well-being. And to have gone from having affliction to clearly, viscerally, palpably experiencing the absence of it, and to know that mind, to know that heart that's free of it. Wow, it's possible. Isn't it something? Many years ago, there was a woman who came and retreat with me once a year. And so one year she came back after being gone for a year, and she said, after that last retreat that I did, before I was always cynical. And after that retreat, my cynicism went away. If she'd said it the afternoon the retreat ended, I would have thought, well, that's nice. But she came back a year later and said, it's gone. Isn't that quite something? So it's possible to have the experience of things that trouble us, that afflict us, the movements of the mind that are really challenging for us, and have the experience that they come to an end. And to know, really know that for yourself, oh, this is possible. Now I don't have to need faith anymore. Now I know it's possible. And now what's important is to have confidence to keep doing it, to keep engaging in this process, clarifying the heart and mind more and more, freeing it more and more. So that description is not a description of cosmic consciousness. It's not a Big Bang experience of enlightenment. It's not having some phenomenally deep metaphysical insight into the nature of reality. It's just kind of seeing something very simple about your own mind. It's potential, it's possible. And it might be a little bit embarrassing if you go to a cocktail party and people say, you know, what's your spiritual life like? And you say, well, it just, you know, I had clinging and then I didn't have it. And they feel sorry for you. I did ayahuasca. I had this great out of the body experience, and you know, I had all this, you know, big, you know, fireworks. And I'm sorry for you. You know, you'll get over it. But in fact, to be able to thoroughly and completely have a peaceful heart, a peaceful mind, untroubled, unafflicted, and one that doesn't pick up the bait of the world, doesn't get caught and tangled again, is one of the great gifts, one of the great wealths and treasures that we have. And it's a transformative experience. You become a person, most people become someone who's radically different than they were before. in that. So, in summary, I want to say that faith is very important. It's not a faith in something, but it's faith with something. It's with faith. And so faith accompanies us, encourages us, supports us, so that we do the practice. It's not about just believing something. That doesn't do enough. We have to believe in the practice and do the practice and have that be supported by that. And then doing the practice, we start seeing and discovering for ourselves. And so we no longer need the faith. Because now at some point we know for ourselves. We know for ourselves what's possible. We know for ourselves what we've done. We know how to get relief, how to get release, how to work through things. We know that if I suffer, one of the best things I could do, perhaps, is to sit down and meditate in the middle of it. Sit and address it that way, rather than trying to run around or avoid it or do something else. And to be able to sit honestly and look suffering directly in the face and sit with it, breathe with it, and work through it, dissolve it, evaporate it, heal it, is, and to know how to do that over and over again in so many circumstances, and have that skill, have that ability, is a phenomenal power that we can acquire. And when that happens, maybe there's still faith or confidence, but the Buddha himself called that at that point, faith becomes a power, or confidence becomes a power, when you know something so well that you know it really engages you and helps you meet this life in an honest way. So what do you have faith in? What do you have faith with? What accompanies you in this difficult life that we have? Do you have faith with your money or your place of residence or your relationships or with status or recreational opportunities or ever new websites, cat videos? So, to have faith. And in a certain way, that the faith that people have in the practice, in the Buddha Dharma, in the teaching, is meant to be the same thing as having faith in oneself. There's no difference. Because to have faith in yourself means to have faith that you can walk this path, that you can engage in it. So, so we have 5 minutes. If anybody would like to ask any questions about what I said or comments, or we have a couple of minutes. If you can use the marina up here in the front.
Thanks, Jill, for the talk. And I have a question about the Padre said during the meditation we need to get to the root of suffering, look at it, breathe with it. But at the same time, maybe I'm only doing entry level meditation, but I'm always told to focus on my breathing and do not get tangled with my thoughts. Then it just sounds a little contradictory, because I think I need to reflect on my past experience and then to actually analyze it, and then maybe I can discover the root of my suffering and how to get through it. Uh-huh. But then on the other side, if I'm only watching my breathing and not think about anything, then great. That can bring another thing, right?
Uh-huh. Great question. So the question is, how can I get to the root of my suffering if I'm just sitting quietly, not thinking, but watching my breath? Yeah. And if I'm going to get to the root of my suffering, I have to kind of think about what happened, my past, and reflect, and all that. So what you're saying, there's some truth to it, but maybe we can think of that there are different roots. There's the roots that exist in the present moment, and then there's the archaeological roots, the roots that are long dead, but had a formative influence on our lives. And so sometimes it's helpful to go back and review one's life and analyze it. And if it's, you know, if that's really needed, sometimes it's nice to do it with a therapist, for example, or a counselor or someone who can really help you kind of understand it, unpack it, ask questions for it, so that, and from a Buddhist point of view, the purpose of doing that is so that we can really stay present for the experience in the present. And what we're looking for Buddhism is not the historical roots, but rather the present moment roots, what's actually active and happening today. And so for that, it doesn't involve thinking. It involves getting concentrated and quiet enough that we can watch or see or listen to that which is very shy, but deep, deep inside. And we'll feel our way into the clinging. We'll feel ourselves into the roots. But it takes a very quiet mind to see the roots of conceit. But you don't have to think about it. In fact, thinking can just obscure it. So part of the function of looking at the breath is not to just become a super good breath meditator, breath watcher, but rather for some people, many people, not everyone, that the breathing is a powerful way to quiet the mind and to sharpen the concentration and to sharpen the mind's ability to see what's going on. And as we get quieter and quieter, it's like we go through layers of the mind. So that, you know, in order to successfully kind of get quiet, we have to work through all kinds of things that keep us from getting still and quiet. So, for example, so first I sit down to meditate, and then all I can think about is food. And so then this desire for sensual pleasure in food has to be worked through. And that's the issue. Boy, I have to really have to learn how to let go of those kinds of thoughts. And then we get quieter, and then we start having a lot of thoughts about sex. And, you know, I just, like, every time I meditate, I'm thinking about sex. And, you know, so that's a layer. So, okay, let's work through that. Let's learn to let go of that and settle. And then that goes away, and then we settle even deeper. And then we notice that we're afraid that no one likes us. And then we go deeper and realize that, you know, and go deeper and deeper. And all these kind of things, that the operating principles that are behind how we live, begin showing ourselves. And from a Buddhist point of view, we're only interested in what's active in the present, not historical. And because that's what's really alive and pertinent. And so some of the things that are alive today have their genesis, their beginning, historically in the past. But it's not always necessary to know what that is. If you're able to stay really present and well, sometimes we run into barriers, we run into a layer where we just can't stay present, we can't find our way through. And then sometimes it's really helpful to do the historical work, because that maybe sometimes will show you where the path through it is to the other side. So you take a break from doing the present moment work, do the historical work, but don't do it when you meditate. Don't use meditation as a time. You can journal, you can go walk with a friend, you can go walk alone and think about it another time. That's what I do. But I don't use meditation as a time to think, because many humans have such a strong habit, if not attachment, to thinking, that if you use meditation to think, then, you know, there's no place in which you're trying to break the habit. Does that make some sense?
Follow up question.
What?
So, yeah, please. Yeah. So, like, when you meditate, and then when you are finally able to work through all the, like, layers obscuring, like the core of, I don't know what, but like, then what did you see there? Like, did you see the what you mentioned as the archaeology, like, reason?
If you take the Buddhist path deep through the layers, the core thing, the most important thing we see is the absence of our clinging.
The absence.
And that absence is where the peace is. That absence is the, and then creates the space for wisdom, for compassion, all kinds of things. But the core function is to discover this absence. So it's, you know, it's not a very, you know, appealing. You know, you don't get wealthy by an absence. You know, you don't have a lot to show off on. Like, look at all this absence I have. I don't have greed. I don't have hate. I don't have fear. I don't have delusion. But you don't get, like, where no one can see it. It's not there. So it's, you know, you don't get a lot of credit. But inside, it feels radically different. Inside, there's not the conflict and not the agitation and not the contraction that all those afflictive forces have. And it feels very different. It's very different to breathe that way. It's like the light has been turned on inside. And, you know, and it's all this space and all this ease and peace.
Thank you.
Okay. So thank you. And thank you for being on this journey together here for this evening. And I hope that your journey continues and takes you far into your heart.